This is a recording of a musical presentation done at Holden Village on July the 2nd, 1997. This is the first of three sessions called Music in America, led by Hans Sontag. Let's listen to his presentation.
When I was asked, I said, okay, why not? I know something about music. I can certainly put something together on about American music. Piece of cake. Go to the library, spend 2 hours, just do a little bit of research, take some notes, and it's done. Little did I know what I was getting myself into. First of all, I looked up the definition. What is American music? And I will quote verbatim by a famous American composer who, for the moment, for reasons you will understand in a moment, will remain unnamed. He said, when he was asked, what is American music? He had a ready answer to this question. The way to write American music is simple. All you have to do is be an American and then write any kind of music you wish. Well, that takes care of that, I suppose. Didn't help me. So, step number two, plan B. I made a list of American composers. I said, how many American composers can there be? The list grew and grew, and I gave up at about 40. I said, I cannot do this. So, what I did, however, let me ask you first, can I have, let's say, three reactions from you? Tell me the name of an American composer you're familiar with and at least one work by his. Can you do that? And one of his compositions? A composition? Okay. Yes. One more. Right. Would you like to come forward and take over? Well, I know, I found out I had a lot to learn. But it became a labor of love, because the more I read, the more I listened, the more I fell in love with American music. This list of American composers grew and grew, and I said, and I made this for me, but then I said, okay, why don't I make a copy? It covers neatly 2 pages on my word processor, and I have about 25 or so copies here for those of you who are interested to take home, which lists the composer, their major interest or activity, and some of their best known compositions. But what I found out that I took a wrong approach, and this talk tonight in 2 sections and a final one on the 4th of July will not be really about music in America. It will not be so much about music, but it will be about America. I found that the history of music in America is the history of our country. And I want you to enjoy together with me the wonderful connections and how America eventually declared its independence in music and other cultural activities from Europe. And I think this is something we should all be very proud of. America is now perhaps one of the leading countries, if not the leading country, in new original music, and we do have now American music. How do we get started? Early until the 19th century, lots of music playing and lots of music existed in this country. It was playing and singing, mostly in churches, in festive events, band concerts, on village greens, so-called singing societies, what you may have heard, schools, choral clubs, salon dances and barn dances. This was all here. However, this kind of music was not American music. This was all transplanted in content from Europe. There was nothing American about The first truly American music was written by someone whom I wish you to name. I won't name him. I will play a couple, maybe three short excerpts of this music, and you tell me whether you are familiar with it. European composer could have written this. Anyone knows this music by name? The title of this music. Well, it is called what? Ring, ring the banjo. You get the first prize. I don't have one, but I conferred it anyway. Who is the author of this happy song? Great. Do you like to hear a little bit more?
Yes.
Of Stephen?
Great.
Wonderful. It so happens it's on the same track, so we can just continue.
This one, more of you would have recognized immediately. Sing along if you wish.
If you are wondering why this music is kind of repetitious, there's not very much content in it. Remember, this was the first attempt to write American music, and was very much written along the lines, the construction, the way the music was put together in the European style. European music was like this, and also these are essentially songs, and they are strophic songs. They have a refrain. So when the text is there, you don't worry so much about the great musical content. The text is important. We will come to this in a moment. Now, who was Stephen Collins Foster, which is a complete name? He is historically our first great composer of truly American music. He lived and wrote popular songs during the pre-Civil War period, which was a great and terrifying period of expansion and consolidation in America. America was a big, violent country for the entire span of Foster's short life, and it convulsed into the Civil War by the time he died. Now, I want you to use your imagination and picture yourself living in that era between the War of 1812 and the Civil War. Our country fought Mexico for Texas, and to our own surprise, we won the entire Southwest. Then we managed to talk the British out of what was then the Oregon Territory. No war. After that, we simply took over what is now the state of California, something that some of us Washingtonians have come to regret ever since. Just kidding. But it is important for us now to understand the spanking newness of things at that point in our country in its very short history. Think of the sheer power we had and the inherent terror of social and cultural momentum. Plenty of people had tried empires, but nobody had done in America before. Curiously, Stephen Foster was born on our most important national holiday, 4th of July, of course. He was our very first popular composer, and what he did was crystallize and refract in his work what musical America had accomplished up to that point. The songs he wrote us tell us about the country he saw and the highly charged emotions manifested by American intellectuals. He was only 11 years old when Ralph Waldo Emerson, in his famous oration at Harvard, demanded that we Americans must engineer another revolution, this time against European cultural dominance, not just music. But this gives you an inkling about the state of mind that was rising in this country. Foster also watched the painters of the Hudson River School, probably are acquainted with, essentially taking the European notion of romanticism and exploding it against the subject of the American wilderness. In Stephen Foster's songs, we hear American musically breaking away from Europe. Now let's listen to another Foster song you all know. It is played by the same instrumental group. Now, you tell me, what is so truly American about these three songs that we just heard in an instrumental version? Anyone? Well, I helped you. I help out. One characteristic of these very American songs is the, I beg your pardon? Instrumentation. That's exactly what I'm talking about. Thank you. It's the kind of instruments used. What do we have here? We have violins, which later turned into the very American and much beloved fiddle. The two instruments are the same, they're played differently. fiddles are played in the country in style bound in the country in the style of bound dances and hold downs. Then we have another instrument that became very important in America for a number of reasons, the banjo. Much beloved, expressive, plucked string instruments was very popular in the American South, especially among black singers, for self-accompaniment to their ballads and tales. Then we have a guitar, indispensable for folk singers to harmonize their tales of religion and philosophy, memories and vision. Two brass instruments, the cornet and the tuba. Cornet is a simplified trumpet. Easy to play, lending accents and rhythmic beat to the strings. And miscellaneous percussion instruments, which are encouraging the dancers to keep the beat. Because the first two songs that we heard were really songs for singing. This is more a song for dancing. How about the vocal part of the lyrics that I haven't introduced yet? They are important, as we will see, but I wanted to play for you just the music, which in itself is unique, eminently pleasing, and memorable, and I saw quite a few feet tapping or big toes discreetly wiggling. People have sandals on. But it is an irresistible music, and that could not have been written anywhere other than here in our country, United States. Many people know Foster's songs simply as dance music, but when we listen to the lyrics to his songs, they become even more truly American, thanks to the subjects he chose to celebrate. And here's one that I must confess, I will confess right now, I knew very little about American music. Now I'm an expert, of course. This is a song which is called That's What's the Matter. The importance of the song, why I chose it to play it here tonight, it was written in 1862. I hope you will be able to hear what is going on here, what he's singing about.
Sad for mirth, too rough for rhymes. The songs of peace have lost their charms, and that's what's the matter.
The men we held as brothers true have turned into a reprobate, so now we have to put them through, and that's what's the matter. That's what's the matter. The rebels have to scatter. We'll make them flee by land and sea, and that's what's the matter.
Once begun, and that's what's the matter. That's what's
played out.
And that's what's the matter. That's what's the matter. The rebels have to scatter. We're ignorantly by land and sea. And that's what's the matter.
It's incredibly beautiful, rhythmic, wonderfully instrumented with two singers who alternate and chorus. It is a rousing song. Now, this is the beginning of American music. Foster was a Pennsylvania native who ventured into the South only once in his life. It is not surprising that the sympathies during the Civil War were with the North. Of course, this song is a comically forthright blast at South and its sympathizers. Nevertheless, he wrote two home and hearth songs that eventually became official Southern state songs, not at his request. One for Kentucky, which I have here, but I'm not going to play for lack of time, and the other one you probably all know. It is your duty as patriotic Americans to know it. So here we go. Very significant. This was written in 1851, to put in a time frame. Song may sound very sentimental to our ears nowadays, but it was deeply felt by Foster at that time. The name of the song, of course, is, well, I hear two versions. Old Folks at Home, and it's also well known as Swanee River. Where was Swanee River? In Florida. Did a Swanee River exist? We doubt it. We are not sure. Foster just chose the name. It was a suggestive, and it fitted so beautifully in his melody and harmonies. Now, this, here I want to bring in something. We have to understand Foster's attitude, and I will tell a little bit about his life. This sentimental song, like most of Foster's songs, yearns for the good old days in a ballad-like setting. Its heartfelt simplicity approaches folk art, which explains his enduring worldwide fame. It is the most celebrated of Foster's so-called Ethiopian songs that are based not on real black spirituals, but on the songs of the Christy minstrel shows. Now, does everybody know what Christy minstrels are? Then I won't spend time. Anyone who does not know what Christy minstrels are is very important. Okay, I'll tell you briefly about it. These were very popular shows which were supposedly funny and entertaining, but they were also an exploitation of the black man, presented by white men with blackened faces in an idiom which was closer to an English ballad and music derived from marches and hymns, not genuine black music. The conventional form of the Christie show had a comic presenter and two stooges armed with tambourine and bones. Bones, I suppose, was to beat the drums, or maybe it was something they wore. They crystallized the white myth of the wide, grinning, dazzling-toothed, red-lipped black man, lazy and good for nothing, yet happy in his innocence. The minstrel show was making him a supposedly harmless figure of fun. Now, Foster's genius lay in revealing the other side of this myth. The black man, although happy, was also homeless, and therefore sad. Foster's songs tell us that the black man's homesickness is related to the frustration and nostalgia in everyone, of whatever color, especially in a raw industrial city with an uncertain future. And we have to look at the song in this connection. We could say with conviction that Stephen Foster was the poet of American nostalgia. How American are Foster's melodies? He clearly had remarkable ears and prescient sense how to use them by collecting the cadence and the melodic line of this country. The sounds of the church, the sounds of the town meeting, of the farm, of the 4th of July, of the fledgling American way of entertainment. His songs were astonishing and vitally pictorial. They have a boisterous wilderness in them and a great freshness untamed by the European form in which they are written. I call Stephen Foster earlier a popular composer, writing popular songs. Generally, when we talk about popular music or pop music, we usually mean all kinds of folk music, which originally was made by mostly illiterate people, and was not written down, but passed on from the village elders to the next generation. But at Foster's time, the creation of popular music simply aimed at entertaining a large number of people. It was a product of industrialization, in which music became a commodity to be bought and to be sold. Interestingly enough, it was in the United States of America, a rapidly industrializing notion, where we first encounter composers who devoted themselves to fulfilling a demand for popular entertainment music, something completely unknown in Europe or the rest of the world. What was Foster's way of making a living? He was a journalist, and he composed the songs in his spare time without the benefit of much formal training in music. His aim was to amuse the middle-class public. He used well-worn clichés from British composers of the early 19th century, evangelical hymns, military marches, Italian romantic opera, and salon music for the piano. He inherited all this and used it. His public was a mixture of English, Irish, German, Italian by ancestry. Their spiritual leanings were heavy towards Puritan heritage. Now, you may be wondering how and why Foster became a composer. He was born in Pennsylvania into a substantial middle-class environment in which music was not even remotely considered to be a suitable career for a man. His parents took note of his talent, but did nothing at all to encourage him or to train him. But young Stephen loved music. He spent many hours along the riverbanks listening to the singing of black workers, probably influencing much of his writing. He was mostly self-taught, and he studied constantly and carefully. He wrote many of his songs for which he is now so famous between 1840 and 1850, among which "O Susanna," which you just heard, became the popular song of the 49ers in their rush westwards to the gold fields of California. This sudden popularity brought him a modest amount of success. In spite of the fabulous appeal of his music, his life was a failure both materially and spiritually. Foster was a dreamer and not a businessman. His wife left him in 1861, leaving him to live a lone and destitute life. After the failure of his marriage, he relapsed into alcoholic despair and died in abject poverty at the age of 38. However, in a short life, he managed to write some 200 songs, some of which imprinted themselves permanently on the American soul. The most deeply touching of his songs is "Jeannie with a Light Brown Hair." Excuse me. And this is the dream image of his lost wife, who walked out of his life. It is perhaps the only of his songs in which the gracefully undulating melody has the haunting simplicity of a real Scots or Irish folk tune, a European heritage. Imbued with tender regret, the simplicity of his art matches the fragility of his dream. This song may still bring tears even to the most sophisticated eyes. I have it here. Would you like to hear it?
Oh.
I selected a cross-section of very different and I hope representative songs of this enormously gifted and very versatile composer. You may have your own opinion about him, if someone would like to comment anything about what you want, if you would like to mention, share. Yeah. All right. The second very important composer appearing on the scene is a name with a strange French, German, Jewish name, Louis Moreau Gottschalk. He was born in New Orleans in 1829 and lived until 1869. I don't know why composers don't live any longer. Gottschalk is our very first, very own, very American musician, virtuoso, and composer. Having been born in New Orleans, he was one of the most colorful figures in the history of music of the United States. We are running a little short on time, but let me tell you a couple of things about him. He was the eldest of seven children, revealed his musical gifts at an early age, and at 13, his parents sent him to Paris, to study. At the age of 16, he was presented in a private debut, where he played, among other major works, the E minor piano concerto by Chopin, who was present and congratulated him after his performance and told him, "Give me your hand, my child. I predict that you will become the king of the pianists." He was also one of the most adored pianists of the Romantic period. Handsome and magnetic, he was a Liszian figure who, after each recital, purposefully left his white gloves on the piano. As soon as he walked up the stage, the ladies stormed upon the stage and tore them to shreds, so they had a little souvenir of their hero and something to press between the pages of a book. While Gottschalk was the first and foremost pianist, it was a rule that the virtuosi of his day had to write much, if not most, of their own material. As a composer, Gottschalk introduced new strains into the music of his time. He was a great innovator. In fact, he actually anticipated many important trends of the future. Now, I am going for the, because of the lack of time, we will have time for that. I will play for you the one of his well-known compositions called The Union. It's a concert paraphrase on national airs. Although Gottschalk was a son of the South, he had fostered a northerner and Gottschalk a southerner. He was born in New Orleans, as I said. His sympathies went with the North. His families had owned slaves whom Gottschalk gave their freedom after his father's death in 1853. The Union is an elaborate fantasy that ingratiated Gottschalk with his northern audiences, and you will find out in a moment why. There are several well-known tunes appear in it, and I'll let you discover on your own what they are. It is significant that the Union is no mere potpourri of patriotic tunes, but uses its themes in an elaborated manner that clearly presages the most mature style of another important American composer, who will not appear in the series, Charles Ives, who was 8 years old when Gottschalk wrote The Union. You see, the importance of the relationships, when they are young, how impressionable they are, and how this influences, and this was one of the greatest propellants of the development of American music. At his first performance in Philadelphia in 1862, the audience's reaction to, in Gottschalk's own words, was unheard of enthusiasm, noisy and patriotic manifestation, recalls, parades, or hurrahs, etc. Here it is, and then I invite you to discover and enjoy and the various tunes that are employed here, at least three, and be proud of how smart you are that you can discover. Eight, track three. thank you for Louis Moreau. You can imagine the reaction that resulted from this very first fledgling attempt to demonstrate the patriotism in a symphonic composition. With a huge orchestra, the public went wild. And this, remember the time, the very critical time, the conflict between the North and South, and this really brought the house down. Louis Moreau Gottschalk is our very first, I repeat this, composer who wrote in the European tradition of symphonies, piano concerti, and not so much in symphonies, but in very colorful music employing all the resources of the big orchestras. And we are going to continue this event here after Vespers at, 8:45. And what you are going to hear is some more of the American composers. And we are going to end the 19th century and enter in the 20th century with the creation of a truly all-American, independent, and very powerful form of music, which is called jazz. And this this took the world in storm and is still one of the most important the contributions of America to the world of music. Thank you. And we will have our Vespers now. I hope you will stay for the second part.